And there we are. Okay. Good evening once again, everybody. Welcome to our final off-season Hoops HD podcast, our September podcast, coming to you live and or on tape delay, depending on when you're watching us. Here at the middle of September, this is our, as I mentioned, this is going to be our very last off-season podcast beginning next month. As we get into October and November, we'll be beginning our normal preseason podcast, moving right into the regular season. We're going to have a great year ahead of us this year, and that's why as a very first step tonight, we want to start out by going back and kind of reintroducing ourselves. For anybody that hasn't seen us recently, that doesn't know why we're here even, we're going to do a very quick introduction of ourselves and a little bit about our site first, and then we've got a couple exciting topics tonight as well. I'll start with myself. My name is Chad Sherwood. I am a bit of a college hoops fan, as I'm the type of guy that probably watches every single game that I can possibly watch, so I guess that kind of makes me a bit of a fan. And I've been following the sport for years. I live in southern New Jersey, right in the heart of Big Ten country here, now that my school, Rutgers, is in the Big Ten.
And A-Sun country, don't forget.
And A-Sun country, now that we have the NJIT in the A-Sun as well.
Yes.
Thank you, David. And let everybody else on our panel here introduce themselves, and let me go from my right to left, and I'm going to start with John Titel here, who John is the most recent member of the Hoops HD team. He's been posting some incredible interviews. If you haven't read them, you absolutely should go and read through them. But John, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and who you are and why you're doing this?
Sure, Chad. Thanks for the kind words. John Titel. I live in Washington, D.C., which is kind of every hoops country between Georgetown and GW and American. We got a bunch of different conferences represented down here in the nation's capital. I've been a college basketball fan as long as I can remember. I went to Penn and Arizona for college and grad school, respectively, so those are my two teams. And just love everything about the sport, from the interviews to the bracketology to watching the games to the tourney. So glad to be on the site and the podcast.
Thanks, John. And we have our other John with us. I guess we have John T. and John S. John S., you're up next.
Oh, hi. Well, as you may or may not have heard from previous podcasts, I live in Cincinnati, Ohio, the heart of Big East country, and also the gateway to the SEC.
Gateway to the SEC now, Big East SEC. I guess that used to be Big Ten country at one point there, John, but that's migrated east on you.
Well, our fans over in Clifton may disagree with that sentiment.
We also have Joby coming to us. Joby's our ACC resident, I believe.
I'm for all I know, I'm right around the corner from John, actually, in Northern Virginia, Washington, D.C. area. Went to UVA. Hopefully that will not become too obnoxious, or maybe hopefully it will, because that means I'll have something positive to talk about. Grew up in Big 12 country, worked in SEC country, now in Big East / ACC country. I've been obviously following the sport since I was a little kid. Hopefully you guys enjoy what I provide, pretty much updating weekly in the beginning, and it will accelerate with the nitty-gritty rankings I try to break down. And upon a run-through, those are the only ratings I've ever seen that actually accurately had UCLA seed-wise last year. If you
do you mean now, that in support of the ratings?
I didn't have it in my preseason.
So anybody wants ratings that will accurately predict a team that does not belong in the tournament,
exactly,
this is the where to go.
Just know how they make
a ringing endorsement. I can accurately predict the committee's screw-ups. Nice going.
And remember, Rhode Island would have been in had they gotten to the finals of their tournament. That's how I truly believe that.
Let's finally go down to the inhuman member of our cast here. I'm not certain what he is. David, why don't you tell us who you are, what you are, why you are?
Well, my name's David Griggs, and I'm from, where is this? Anyway, I'm from wherever this is, and I've been a college basketball fan ever since I started watching the border war between Kansas and Missouri. I really wish they'd bring that rivalry back. Anyway, and that's really all I mean, all the other 348 games are great, and there's tens of thousands a game a year, but it just isn't the same without Kansas and Missouri.
Well, David, I think the more important question we have, though, is you've got those big eyes up there, look maybe like something crossed between Kermit the Frog and what are you?
Well, I mean, as you, I kind of morphed into existence. I don't really know when and where, but I you discovered me. I can't remember which bar it was that I got thrown out of because it's happened so many times, but I was just rambling, as you said, incoherently about college basketball, but that I wasn't making any sense, but was still making much more sense than people in the media. So
that is true, actually. So
right.
But what we also want to do today is what I'm going to do, if this works, hopefully, is toss up on my screen here our Hoops HD website. And do we see that?
No, Chad. Oh, we do.
Okay, there we go. All right. And just want to do a quick rundown so just everyone can know some of the features that we have here. And I'm actually on the wrong page there, so let me switch back to our main page. There is our main home page. As you can see, all of our most recent articles will be right there on the top, and you can see John's interview today with Zach Showalter from Wisconsin, another one of his great interviews, right there on the top, and that's the first thing you'll find when you go on to hoopshd.com. But we also have this...
That was my idea, by the way, to put the most recent interviews on the top. That was me.
Good idea.
I came up with it.
Our second page here, About Us, this just gives us a little information about who we are, which we just kind of went over with you guys anyhow. Our third page, going along the line, is our bracket projections. David, where's our most recent bracket?
It's in the archives somewhere.
We will have our first preseason bracket coming up here on this page probably the next month and a half or so, so keep an eye out here. And our most recent bracket all season will be there. You see there are tabs here for conference tournaments, in-season tournaments, all the details you need to know for who, when, where for the conference tournaments, a new page now this season for the in-season tournaments
I'd
also.
I'd like to thank Chad for showing us a blank page of when the next bracket's going to be. Great
well, that now we
great
should
television we got here going, Chad.
We should have the in-season tournaments page up now. It's a little bit of a delay here. But this is a new edition this year, so every in-season tournament bracket and game will be on here. We're actually going to have a podcast at some point. We're going to go through all these in-season tournaments and give our predictions. And the next page is actually where Joby's nitty-gritty rankings are. This is another blank page. Joby, why don't you actually tell us what the nitty-gritty rankings are?
Out of the park tonight.
The theory is it measures the components the committee has stated that they care about and tries to weight them based on both historical component of that application as well in a dynamic fashion. For instance, one of the criticisms you'll have is, unlike a Sagarin, which is more accurate, I would say, than, for instance, mine is, Sagarin's going to tell you, oh, if number 49, if you beat number 49 and you beat number 51, you beat basically the same team. The committee historically will give so much more credit for beating number 49 than 51, even though they say they won't. It's remarkable. And so those little human error components I have tried to throw into computer-like form.
And we'll see again at the end of the season how accurately they predict bad teams making the field. And then
it's true.
We also see on the second line of things here, there's our video streaming guide. If you are looking for a game and it's not televised, take a look here. They're listed by conference. You can almost every game is video streamed these days, so you can probably find the source for it here if you don't know where it is. There's a link to get to our message board.
Don't go to that.
I won't go to our selection committee. I'm going to skip down to the season previews. This is where, if you missed any of John's interviews, they're alphabetically listed here by school. You can go and click right on whichever interview you want to read. You'll also see our conference previews and our podcast. Season podcast will be linked on here once we get to October. The final board that I want to take a look at here, though, is our NCAA Tournament Survival Board. And this is this is probably the most important screen on our site.
Yes.
David, can you tell us why?
Well, what it is that the actual this is available to the actual selection committee. I mean, they can pull this up in the room. They can actually log on to our site in the room from their smartphones or computers or anything. It's one of a few trillion sites on the internet that they're able to access from the room, right here. And what it does is that it lists just every team that is left playing and what their status is. Whether or not they're already in the tournament, whether or not they're being considered, or whether or not they're out, but they're still playing in their conference tournament, but they could get in. This is basically where they get their information so they know who's in and who's out. This page right here.
And as we saw, everybody on this page is still under consideration. So there are, although there's 351 teams in Division I, 9 of them have already been eliminated. They're listed right at the top there, either because they're transitional or they're on an APR ban this year. But there are 342 teams as we speak with a shot to win next season's championship.
And the committee knows that because it's on this page.
And which actually brings me to our first of our news and notes that we want to go through today. We've been following on the site here the plight of Southern University for the past couple of years. Southern University, basically the NCAA found out that since they started requiring the APR reporting back in 2003, Southern had been doing it all completely wrong. None of their data was valid, and they couldn't reconstruct it for some reason. As a result of which, all athletic programs at Southern were banned from postseason play for the past two seasons. The good news for Southern, that blanket ban is done and over with. Southern programs are now postseason eligible if they qualify under the academic progress rate for their individual sport. As part of the deal with the NCAA, Southern actually has until September 28th of this year to submit all their APR data. So as we sit here right now, there has not been a decision as to whether Southern's basketball team will be postseason eligible because they haven't calculated the APR data yet. So that's why there's a chance if Southern's numbers are not good enough, they could come back off of that list, so we could be down to 341. But that's the current status with Southern. But at least there's a shot they could be postseason eligible this year, which is better than the last two seasons.
And I don't know if they just weren't doing it or if they were doing it wrong. Either seems plausible, but it was a new administration, a new AD comes in, and he discovers that nothing has been done correctly, and this really fired us up if you were watching under the radar back then, which you probably weren't, but I don't know. It just bothers me that you could have such inept leadership and, compliance and administration that you would hurt the kids that way. So I'm actually happy. I know it's Southern. I realize that there's someone that we'll only be talking about on Under the Radar, but I'm glad that those kids have their season back, hopefully.
Hopefully. Speaking of schools that have problems with their athletic directors, that's an excellent segue to one of the big breaking news stories this week. The Texas athletic director is out of his job. Let me turn to John T. on this. John, any information about this breaking story here?
I was kind of surprised, actually. I had the pleasure of meeting Athletic Director Steve Patterson back at the NCAA convention in January, and super nice guy, and was able to hook me up with a phone interview in the months afterwards, and didn't seem like there was any problems. He was bringing in Shaka Smart to replace Rick Barnes, and I thought that the program was going to be able to, if not get back to the Final Four anytime soon, which I think is too big a step. They have a lot of talent. I think we know Shaka knows how to coach in March, so I thought they had made a move in the right direction. So I was kind of shocked. I know they haven't had the success that other schools have had in terms of the top tier, and at Texas they expect to be top tier. They have a huge budget and a huge revenue, and they make a ton of money, and they have a lot of boosters. So I don't know who they're going to get to replace them, but I was surprised
with the decision. I have decided that I am going to be the next Texas athletic director. The puppet is going to Texas. That is my plan, and I'm announcing it on this show. I will be in touch with them, and we are going to follow this progress as I transition to Texas right here at Oops HD. But apparently this guy – I mean, how do you hire Shaka Smart and Charlie Strong, two really highly strong hires by all indication, and still be that disliked and lose your job? I mean, almost no one was unhappy about this, including Steve Patterson, I think, who's getting over $5.5 million. To not work at Texas. And what I am willing to do is that I am willing to not work at Texas for just $3 million.
That's very bold of you.
Yes.
I had good connections during the whole on the football side of things, the whole Saban surge. Charlie Strong is right now going to have a little bit of a leash. That's not the issue. There is disappointment over the Saban issue. But it comes down to one basic thing and then one, you know, a cause and then an effect. The cause was he was hired by Bill Powers, the former president. New president comes in. That by itself doesn't necessarily mean, oh, I want my own people. It does when boosters on both the academic and the athletic side, to a T, almost across the board, say, I hate this guy. This guy won't, you know, I don't, and it's personal offense stuff, like, you know, not shaking a guy's hand, and the just silly political stuff that got in the way. But if you're an athletic director, all of us have been around college sports, you have to be part politician as well as do your job. And unfortunately, he didn't have that political gene. We saw it in Michigan, if you remember. And he did the exact same problem in Michigan. He raised ticket prices slightly.
I like how you slid in that slightly.
Across the masses, not just the booster, the high-end boosters. This could have been prevented easily, in my opinion, precisely because of the positive things John said he had done today. But you got to do that part of the job.
You too, and in a place like Texas, not to jump in here, but like at Texas, at Michigan, at your big power schools, your athletic director probably isn't really doing much administrative work around the school. He really is the billboard. Your sport administrators or your associate ADs are, for the most part, who's running the department. And there are some great associate ADs that just aren't people. And apparently that's what this guy was. He didn't want to deal with the boosters. He didn't want to be on the billboard. He didn't want to shake hands. But a lot of people don't. A lot of people who are really good managers and really good administrators don't like doing that either. But they're not at power programs, or if they are, they're associate ADs.
And I don't understand. Also, to be very blunt, why, if you're going to hire Shaka Smart, if you're going to hire Charlie Strong and have, you know, strong baseball program, et cetera, at Texas, you're telling me you have to schedule with an associate athletic director if you're Charlie Strong without talking to the AD? That's outrageous. Sorry. Charlie Strong is more powerful. The coach at Texas football is more powerful than an athletic director, right or wrong. And he's your boss, even though you hired him. In a lot of ways.
I do find it kind of interesting. Some of the names I have heard thrown out there as potential replacements for the AD, besides Mr. Griggs, people like the current executive vice president of the NCAA and the current commissioner of the Big 12 conference.
No.
You would think that would, in theory, be a step down, but it really is a step up because we're talking about Texas. Isn't it kind of amazing, though, that it's a better job to be running one of the schools than running the entire conference or running the entire
NCAA. You have your own network if you're in Texas. Yeah. I mean, you might not have your own network if you're in even the ACC.
Well, I'm going to sell that network.
Let me bring John S. into the conversation here as well about the other major story we have breaking this week, and that was that Gary Parrish over at CBS Sports published an article that has gotten a little bit of backlash to him, stating that there are major infractions at San Diego State. Level one violations by Steve Fisher, which are the equivalent of the stuff that happened back when he was at Michigan. We're talking about potentially significant cash contributions to
more than $10,000, so everyone's clear on what a level one violation is. It's a lot. It isn't a few tickets. It isn't a few thousand dollars even. It's five figures or more.
We're talking about SMU Gold Trans Ams here.
Yeah.
And John S., let me throw this at you here. Any thoughts about this story? I know San Diego State has denied everything vehemently and say, hey, we haven't got anything from the NCAA. We don't know what you're talking about, pretty much.
Yeah, it sounds like maybe a couple of unnamed sources that just jumped the gun, so to speak, because it was an article that came out in the San Diego Union Tribune yesterday where the reporter was contacting San Diego State. Had they heard from the NCAA in regards to any violations? And they said, no, they have not heard anything, and obviously they would cooperate fully with any investigation that would be forthcoming. So anything would be in the preliminary stages. They have not received any notice of inquiry. And here's another part that the puppet is going to like here. When the Union Tribune contacted the NCAA, they were directed to fill out some kind of contact form to reach the NCAA, and then someone responded, "We can't comment on any potential or pending investigation."
I just love the NCAA. A reporter calls up with a very simple, basic yes-no question. Are you investigating San Diego State, yes or no? And their answer to him is that he needs to fill out a form. I just can't stop laughing at that.
John T., do you have any other information on this? Do you think that this is a legitimate investigation going on here, or do you think that you know, Gary may have gotten some stories crossed?
I don't want to really engage in any speculation because I think that's all it is at this point. And from what I know of Fisher, I think his record is relatively clean. Obviously, that's a big term, but he's quite a program at San Diego State. I think he wins 20 games a year and has done so for the past decade, made a bunch of tourneys. He hasn't made it to the next level in terms of getting to a Final Four, I don't think, but he's brought in a lot of talent that has gone to succeed in the NBA. So until I fill out my own form, I don't really have too much to contribute, I don't think.
Yeah, it is interesting. It's going to definitely be a story that we're going to be looking at and following. I mean, I doubt anything will get resolved this year. If it's like North Carolina, it'll be going on for the next 10 years. But definitely a story we'll be following if anything more comes of it. We have a couple other pieces of news and notes we want to go over really quickly here. One realignment piece of news: Coastal Carolina has announced that they're going to be moving, starting next season, from the Big South to the Sun Belt. One of the net effects of that will be that Coastal Carolina has been hosting the Big South Conference Tournament every year, which we think is completely unfair that a team that could finish in second or third place gets to host the conference tournament. I'm assuming they will no longer be hosting the conference tournament, although I guess the Big South could still use their facility if they felt like it.
Yeah.
Which actually will mean that the top seed hopefully will be better protected a little bit in the Big South.
Real quick, and I know it's got to be, was anyone else surprised by this? I admittedly was. I thought it was going to be Eastern Kentucky. I thought it was a done deal. I thought that they were actually creating staff positions and making plans to move up to the FBS. I mean, I realized that in basketball, the Sun Belt and Ohio Valley aren't that far apart, but Coastal Carolina was a curious pick. I don't think anybody outside of that area really even knew they were looking to move up, much less were a viable candidate to move up, much less, again, being the pick to move up. Their football stadium is less than 10,000 people. It's smaller than most basketball arenas, so they're going to need a new stadium, and I would assume they're going to need a new basketball arena too, won't they? I was a little surprised.
Well, I was surprised on the football side. But one sport that the Sun Belt is actually pretty strong in, the Coastal Carolina is is consistently strong in, is baseball. And maybe baseball, I know it sounds weird that baseball would wag any tail in the college game, but that is a place where the Sun Belt can strike and make some NCAA noise. Coastal does that. I mean, they're a regional protected number one seed sometimes. Mm-hmm. So maybe that was a thought. They do excel at a sport that can be revenue in the right situation.
And I would just point out here that I wouldn't give up if I was Eastern Kentucky quite yet, as there was also some noise from Carl Benson, the Sun Belt commissioner, about the fact that Idaho and New Mexico State's affiliation technically ends after next year, or it's up for renewal. And Idaho's results on the football field have been pathetic. And they may not want Idaho anymore.
Well, the other thing is that, I mean, have you been to Coastal Carolina? It's in Myrtle Beach. It's beautiful. They got strip clubs everywhere. Richmond, Eastern Kentucky, they don't have any.
UMass is going to be looking for a new conference after this year when they leave the MAC as an affiliate member.
Yeah.
I'm going to go after them.
And speaking of the MAC and conferences, one other topic we wanted to hit on for this upcoming year, there was an article that we were talking about, not on the air at all, where there is a general feeling by the by the coaches and the athletic directors from the smaller schools that they want to, that they should be in a reward for being the number one team in your conference in the regular season and not suddenly be thrown out there in the conference tournament with a shot to be just knocked out by some crazy upset. And we've seen a lot of conferences that have gone with double bye systems or home court advantages for their top seeds in order to try to protect them, giving them a better shot to advance to the conference tournament championship and potentially make it to the NCAA tournament. There have been three conferences who made significant changes to their conference tournament formats this year: the Mid-American, the Big Sky, and the Horizon. And all three of them, with the MAC, they've gone away from the double bye system to a more standard format. Big Sky, they have gone away from the regular season champion hosting the conference tournament, and they're moving it to a neutral site. And the same thing with the Horizon League, although it's not even a neutral site. They're playing in Detroit, where one of their schools is located, although not on Detroit, University of Detroit's home court. So despite all that noise from these coaches and athletic directors, three conferences have made it harder for the number one seed to win the conference tournament this year.
Let me clarify one other thing about the MAC. They had triple buys for the number one and the number two seeds, and then they had double buys for the number three and the number four seeds, and everyone 5 through 12 would play the first round on campus, and after those on campus games, then they would move over to Cleveland.
Right, and the system now is there's still going to be the on-campus games for 5 through 12, but those four winners will advance to four quarterfinals against the top four seeds, who will only get a standard bye, which would be a standard format for a 12-team tournament.
Okay, and just to be clear, for your Power 5, your multi-bid 10, whatever you want to call what we don't consider under the radar to be, I really don't care how they work their tournaments because it is extremely rare that their first place team would need any sort of help at all. For everybody else, it makes absolutely no sense at all to not help out your first place team, much less go to a format that does even less for them. The Horizon League, the last 2 years at least, and maybe the last three or four, but definitely the last two, was hugely exciting during the regular season. Going into the final week last year, there were still three teams that could have finished in first place. And
the good teams. Challenging NCAA level teams.
Yeah, and the build up to that, before that, it just added so much more intensity, meaning stakes to the regular season because you want those home games and you want that double bye. They have essentially killed that. Yes, at the end of the day, one bid leagues do not just fall out of the sky. If you get out there in November and December and you win big, if the Horizon League gets out there and wins 80% of their games the way the ACC and SEC do, then yeah, they'll send 4 and 5 and 6 teams. But realistically, why would you water down your regular season? It hurts your regular season. But from a monetary standpoint, you don't get the home court advantages, so the crowds aren't as good, and you make it harder for your best team to get into the tournament, which gives you the best chance of doing well in the tournament. There is no good reason at all to go to this format that I can think of. I'm not happy about it.
Well, does anybody disagree with David? Is there a good reason to go to change your format to take away the advantages, the double buys, the home courts for the top seeds? John?
Sure, I'll weigh in on that. So I think that it's nice to give your conference the best chance to win in the NCAA tourney, and therefore you want your strongest team, and therefore the one seed should get an extra buy or two. I get all that. To be honest, I think it's kind of a crapshoot. I was looking at last year's conference tourneys. There were some that went right according to format. America East and Atlantic Sun, they're both 8-team conference tourneys with 8 teams who make it, and nobody gets a bye. Number one seed in the America East was Albany. They won it. They went to the tourney. Number one seed in the Atlantic Sun, North Florida, won it. They went to the tourney. They
didn't have any extra buys. If I just intervene there, both those conferences use home court, though, for all games.
Yeah.
So Albany and North Florida got to play every game on their home court.
No, that's a very good point. I think that might be the advantage that other people say a bye would provide, but obviously playing on your home court helps. We mentioned Coastal Carolina. They were in the Big South. They might not be in the future. They won it. They weren't the one seed. They were the 3 seed. The top 5 teams of the 11 in that conference tourney get a bye, If you want to know how the number one seed Charleston Southern and the number two seed High Point did, upset in the quarterfinal. It doesn't guarantee anything, obviously.
Absolutely, John. Let me be clear on what my stance is. I'm not for buys. I'm for protecting your first place team in some way. I would prefer the campus sites, which is what the Horizon League did. In what the America East, like, we whined all last year that the Big South did not use a campus site format.
Yeah, what the Big South used last year was they played the conference tournament at Coastal Carolina.
Right.
What happened? The three seed Coastal Carolina won the conference tournament. I think that that argument about the Big South is more argument, again, that the top seed should be allowed to play its conference tournament on its home court. And
yeah.
I agree with David. The double buy system, I'm fine with avoiding that if you give them the home court.
Right,
the Big
yeah.
Sky change is the perfect example. The Big Sky for years has allowed the top seed to host the entirety of the conference tournament. Now, if Eastern Washington wins the regular season of the Big Sky this year, they've got to go play in Reno, Nevada, which is a lot closer to a school like Sacramento State or Northern Arizona than it is to wherever the heck Eastern Washington is.
So, but yeah,
well, it's funny you mentioned Sacramento State, Chad, because I think their facility was going to be too small had they gotten the number one seed themselves last year. I don't know if they would have been allowed to host in the arena, or whether they would have had to find another suitable facility.
They actually had a backup plan. They had a plan for a temporary arena on campus.
Temporary arena on campus.
But a larger gymnasium on campus that they would have brought in temporary seating for.
Yeah.
And there is an NBA arena in Sacramento last
right.
I heard.
But yeah, but just to be clear, like in the Big South last year was a perfect example because in the second half of conference play, there were seven teams separated by one game. And you want to talk about stakes, excitement for your regular season, all those teams fighting to host games in the conference tournament would have made that so much more exciting. And it's not fair to the teams that John mentioned. It's not fair to Charleston Southern that they didn't get to play at home. They earned the right to play at home. Anyway.
Well, with that, I think we're going to move on to our first of our two main topics of the
night. I'm sorry, John, I cut you off. Did you want to finish your thought? I'm sorry about that.
No, I think you guys, I like the part about the home court, so I think you summed it up very nicely.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's what I do here.
Let's move on to one of the other scheduling is one of the issues that we wanted to discuss. And David, I know you're big into the following off-season scheduling and following teams as they build their off-season schedules. And at this point here in the middle of September, I would say 95% of all non-conference scheduling is probably done. I think there's still a few teams out there looking to flesh out their schedules with one or two more games, which will probably end up being NAIA teams or D2 teams and the like. But David, I know you had some thoughts on this, so let me just turn it over to you for this section.
Okay, I'll start out with a good one. And this is really hard to do when you don't have any arms or hands. So if we can, we might be pulling some team schedules up on the site. So we'll use the share screen feature. I'll start out with a team schedule who I love and how they've scheduled the past 2 years, and Joby's Hoos. I think they're only playing two bye games. I think they're going to Ohio State. They're going to George Washington. One of the things that they've been doing that I think is a great scheduling philosophy that almost no one does is they've started to play early season, if not season openers, on the road against regional opponents. I believe they're going to William & Mary next year. Is that right, Joby, to open the season?
As I remember, that's right. I mean, it's burned them in the past. I mean, they lost to an average Mason team on the road, but they do that.
Right, but here's what it does. First of all, it fades into the background. I realize that, Ohio State, they don't want to go to Dayton or to Xavier or even to Toledo or Akron or Ohio. And you get that, but I think what Tony Bennett has discovered is if you go there and lose, so what?
Yeah.
And they have lost, and it hasn't hurt them. And I
they
think
lost to VCU a few years ago, but then they beat VCU. So it goes, you know, and that's a respected game, win or lose.
Right, and it's a road game. It gets your guys used to playing on the road early, and I think they played the year they won the ACC, they lost some out-of-conference road games to – a Green Bay.
The famous Tennessee game. They got doubled. They got doubled in Knoxville. And they didn't lose almost another game the rest of the year.
The question here, when you're looking at a team's resume in March to determine if they belong in the tournament or not, would you rather see a home win over Prairie View or a road loss to George Mason or a road loss to VCU? Yeah. And if I'm on the selection committee, I'd rather say, hey, you went out, you challenged yourself on the road, and you lost by 2 points at VCU versus, oh, hey, you picked up a 55-point win over the number 325 team in the country.
Right. I think my answer to that it's kind of weird, which would you rather see? It's, well, do you reward a team for beating Prairie View? No. Do you penalize a team for going on the road, even if it's against, like, an under-the-radar team or a VCU or an Akron or some of these snake pits where these aren't NCAA tournament caliber teams, but they are teams that win 80% of their games at home, if not more. If you go there and lose, and it's November of all times, do you really hold it against them? I don't think you do. And they didn't. Virginia went to Green Bay and lost and got a one seed. Yep. You know. So I like teams that are going to be able to do that. I think that there's more strategy to that than what I think a lot of other schools, it's just like it's eating your vegetables. Well, I don't want to go on the road. It's not pleasant and all that. But when you do it, even when you lose, it gets you used to playing on the road. It gets you used to hostile conference environments. And I think Virginia has benefited from that. I think other teams would too. The other part of it is the on-paper part. And I'll pick on the Big East a little bit here because they're unique. Like, if you look at Xavier, you've got Wright State, you've got Northern Kentucky. You look at Creighton, you got Omaha. You look at Seton Hall, you got St. Peter's, NJIT. St. John's has all the New Yorks. You know, Providence has Brown. All of these schools have regional opponents that they could schedule, play on the road, and if they were to do it, 70% of the arena would be for them, so it wouldn't be the normal hostility of a road game. And if you look at the RPI matrix, you essentially get more than double what you would get for beating that team at home. So even if every team in a conference did that, they scheduled a game like that against a regional opponent, and instead of like a 99% chance of beating them at home, which is what you would get in a normal bye game, you win 80% of those. Your conference metric goes through the roof for winning games that really aren't that much harder to win. Am I sounding way too much like math class here? I think there is a strategic advantage, and I realize a lot of schools don't schedule this way, they don't think this way, to playing road games like Virginia's doing against regional opponents.
Now, David mentioned Xavier's schedule. I'm surprised you didn't mention the one team that they didn't schedule locally, and that's Dayton.
We're going to get to who Kansas didn't schedule as well. We're going to spend about an hour on that.
Just another team I'll throw out there. I mean, we talk about scheduling. I mean, the joke every year with Syracuse, they refuse to leave the state of New York. Actually, this year it's going to be a little different because they are going to be playing in the Battle for Atlantis in the Bahamas, as well as having a game at Georgetown, in December.
So, is that at Georgetown or is that at the Garden?
It's at Georgetown this year.
It's at Georgetown. They're going to be playing they'll be playing in the Garden against St. John's as well.
Okay.
The scheduling issue here. Let me throw it to John T. Your thoughts on the way these teams have been scheduling.
So a couple of thoughts. Number one, I try to interview any members of the selection committee I can every March, and one of the questions I always ask them is that if you want to make the tourney, are you better off scheduling a decent team who you think you can beat, or a great team who you can only hope to upset, or a nice mix? And I think they often say it's a nice mix. It's not all or nothing. So I think as long as you mix it up, like if you go to Charlottesville and lose to Virginia, I don't think that's really going to hurt you because they're a great team, obviously. If you go beat Prairie View wherever, at home or on the road, I don't think it's really going to bump up the resume that much. I was looking at some of the schedules. You mentioned Kansas's schedule. It looked pretty impressive to me.
Missouri is not on it. That's the problem.
But they're the only one who's not. They got Michigan State, they got UCLA, they got one of Indiana or St. John's, they got Oregon State, San Diego State, Kentucky. I mean, that's a pretty loaded non-conference schedule to me. And if you're looking for a team who's going to pull, I remember back in the day Clemson would always start 18-0 because they'd scheduled nobody. Two that jumped out to me, Baylor, their big games are Oregon, Vanderbilt, and Texas A&M. And NC State has Arizona State, Michigan, and Missouri.
Well, Kansas needs to play Missouri. I think they need to play them three or four times. But
Kansas State this year.
Yeah. But Kansas always gets out there and plays a – the last couple years, they've played a killer schedule, and they're not doing all of that at home either. I mean, they get out there and they play.
Well, when John Chaney was head coach at Temple, every year Temple had probably the hardest non-conference schedule in the country. He would play everybody on the road. They would not have an overall impressive record, but they were an NCAA tournament team every year, despite playing in an Atlantic 10 conference that was definitely not elite. It had a couple good years, but was not elite. That's if you schedule like that, you get rewarded, and you get in the tournament, and you don't have to win all those games.
Right.
If you schedule Prairie View and you lose at home to Prairie View, all you can do is hurt yourself by having a really bad loss on your resume, and you can do nothing to help yourself other than getting some fans in and selling some tickets and some beers.
Yeah, speaking of, one of the John said something funny, a little bit of everything. Can we get Marquette's schedule up, please? This is a bizarrely they're playing sub 300 teams and top 10 teams and basically no one in between.
But you see, I think even with the top 10 teams, I think they will at least get the credit for that. The schedules that I really hate are when you go and you schedule a bunch of sub 300 teams, and then you try to fill it out with Oregon State and Clemson and Rutgers. Not to offend my own school, but
the schedules that drive me nuts. There is a distinct, and call it the Utah State schedule. Let's call it mid-major. If you're a mid-major program who you think has a shot at the NCAAs, go out and do what Gonzaga does. Go out and do what a lot of mid-major teams do, which is go out and schedule real teams. You mentioned George Washington, they do it. Go out and schedule people. Don't rack up a Stephen F. Austin 28-3 and say, Huck, we deserve to be in, no question asked. You can do it, and what makes me more angry than anything else is, well, no one will play us. That's so wrong. That is absolutely on its face wrong. May have been true 10 years ago, but people understand RPIs now. People understand strength. Texas A&M and Texas, I bet you they would play Stephen F. now.
Yeah, Murray State comes to mind. Stephen F. Austin comes to mind a little bit, but Murray State last year was whining about how no one would play them. And you get on Basketball Travelers, and I realize it's not something that everyone can really access, but your ads read like this. Looking for top 50 opponent from a Power 5 BCS conference on, between November 20th and November 27th, what must start at home. Okay, the more particulars, everybody is so particular about their schedule. Like, there are schools that only want to play on the road if it's on a weekend. There are schools that only want to play on the road if it's against another Power 5 team or if it's on national television. Or they want to play top 50 opponents, but only, like, name brand top 50 opponents. And, like, and there's 350 schools, and all of them are picky. And I think in order to put together a decent schedule, you're going to have to concede something. Colorado State, Larry Eustace was saying that he had to schedule Division II teams because no one would play them. Really? Denver would not play you. You know, your own front range rival would not play. I just don't believe it.
They want to do home and homes with top teams. And
yes.
Colorado State, Duke is not going to give you a home and home. Kansas is not going to give you a home and home.
Right. And you have to concede that. Is it fair? Probably not. But you might have to do a home neutral where you go to Denver and play, and then you go to their place. Or you might have to do for a 2-for-1. Or you might have to do what I think Belmont does a great job scheduling, and they don't get many home games. But they go on the road. Belmont's good this year. I think Belmont fits the description of what Joby said, a team from a weak league that might be NCAA tournament caliber. But they're getting out there and they're playing.
Dayton did do it for one recently.
What's
that? And I might add, Gonzaga used to not get home and homes. They get home and homes now.
Yeah.
They used to not get home and homes to the Kennel. They earned it. They went out on the road. They became road warriors. Now they're a name brand. They get home and homes.
Yeah.
Earn it, Utah State.
Yeah.
Although Utah State's scheduled a little bit better this year, although with Stu Morrill having retired, that may be a major part of it.
Yeah. But again, having said that, a little more, not just making the NCAA tournament, one of the things that drives me nuts about scheduling, in a lot of your ranked Power Conference teams will play 7, 8, 9 games at home, and you know, out of the 13 out-of-conference games they're playing, or 11 depending on their conference schedule, 8 or 9 of them are jokes. I don't think it's good for college basketball in general when 70% of your out-of-conference games are absolutely horrible. And they are.
All right. Well, with on that, I think we want to move on to our last topic here for the night, which is the cost of living stipend. And I know David and I, you and I had a conversation earlier today about this, and I want to kind of throw it out there to both Johns and to Joby on this issue, because you and I both kind of came to the conclusion that we have no idea what the hell is going on with this cost of living stipend. Let me tell you, though, first what we were able to determine. And that is, supposedly, based upon where your school is, the determination of what the cost of living in that area is. And then you take your tuition plus the cost of living minus your tuition, and that determines what the extra stipend is going to be. Now, your tuition minus your tuition equals zero. So, theoretically, if you live in a city of, say, Cincinnati, and you go to Xavier, or you go to the University of Cincinnati, your cost of living stipend should be pretty identical. Now, the numbers are being released, and there's about a $3,000 discrepancy, I believe, between what Xavier and what Cincinnati are paying as the cost of living stipend. Despite the fact that these schools are, what, 3 blocks away from each other?
They're 3 miles apart. Students, from what I understand, live in the same apartment buildings and are even roommates together. A point of a little thing here is that the cost of living for a particular city is X amount, and like your overall cost of living. So your stipend is supposed to be X amount minus your tuition. In theory, your private schools that cost more, that's going to be a smaller number than your public schools with lower tuitions. So your publics will be able to pay out a higher cost of living stipend because there's a bigger gap between the tuition and the overall cost. That's how it was explained to me. I don't know if that was an accurate explanation. I understand that principle, but I'm having a hard time following it. But what I don't get is how 2 schools that are literally in the same neighborhood could be $4,000 apart in what they're paying in cost of living.
Okay, and just give those numbers here. It's actually John S. has them up on his screen. Cincinnati's number is $6,082. And can we get Xavier's number up there?
Yep, let me scroll down, and we'll get to Xavier's figure. Oh, I went too far.
Oh, wow, that's
we're seeing a couple players here. Okay, there we go. We see Xavier's number is $2,300. That's almost a $4,000 difference. Let's run through. Again, I don't understand how 2 schools 3 miles apart could have such a difference in what they believe the cost of living in that same city is. Can somebody please explain this? Because I honestly, David's explanation still makes no sense to me.
It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me either.
Let's do another apples-to-apples comparison right here. As we see, Xavier, for example, is $2,300. And if we go up the line to Dayton, which is relatively similar in terms of cost of living to the Cincinnati area, their stipend is listed at about $2,884.
And that's close enough to Xavier's number to make a little sense to me, but how does Cincinnati pay 3 times that much? John T., do you have any explanation for this?
I do, but you're not going to like it. So from what I've been able to figure out about this, you keep calling it a cost of living stipend, which I don't think is necessarily wrong, but I've seen it more accurately, in my opinion, described as a cost of attendance stipend. Perhaps it's just semantics, but I think that it's not just about the cost of living in the city of Cincinnati, Ohio, or wherever. It's the actual cost of attendance, and my understanding is that each school's financial aid office gets to calculate their own cost, so that Penn and Drexel are literally down the street from each other in Philly, as are a bunch of other schools throughout Philadelphia. If Penn says, oh, like, your cost of attendance, you're going to need a computer and a cell phone and school supplies and food, and Drexel says, yeah, well, you only need a little of this and a little of that, Penn's financial aid office can literally institute a double or triple the cost of Drexel's cost of attendance, and they're allowed to do that, my understanding, because each school gets to do their own thing. The other thing that – sorry, go ahead.
Now, I was just going to let you finish it.
This is a really good explanation.
Yeah, please go ahead.
The one other thing that caught my eye is that, as you might imagine, not every single school across the country makes a profit. I believe it's only about a couple dozen FBS programs each year. Everybody else is operating in the red. So if that's the case, they're already not being able to cover their costs. Now they got to come up with anywhere from $1,500 to $5,500 or more per student to supply the cost of attendance. I'm worried that the way they're going to make up for it is to cut smaller non-revenue sports. So for those of you who enjoy the field hockey team or whatever, like, good luck, because I'm worried that they might be the ones who suffer.
Right. Well, just my issue with
all your men's swimming and men's golf teams cut, because Title IX will rear its head.
Yeah, but my issue with it here is let's say you've got two schools that are, let's go back to the Cincinnati Xavier example. You got a kid who's grown up without very much money at all in a tough neighborhood, maybe in Cincinnati itself, and he's trying to, but he's a basketball recruit, a top recruit. He's trying to decide between going to Cincinnati and Xavier, and he finds out if he goes to Xavier, he'll get an extra $2,000 each year, or if he goes to Cincinnati, he'll get an extra $6,000 each year. Do we need to go any further? And isn't that exactly what we're not supposed to be doing in recruiting? I think that I have a feeling this could get worse. I mean, what if a financial aid office suddenly says, well, you know what? The cost of attendance at SMU is $25,000 extra a year. So everybody come get your gold Trans Ams. I think we've opened up a can of worms here that we may not be able to close.
But you're also forgetting one other big detail in regards to Cincinnati, though. As you probably heard just around the beginning of football season, the Cincinnati football program was talking about possible disciplinary reasons where they would reduce the cost of attendance stipend. I don't know if this has been hammered down since then.
Yes, that's a good point, John. They were basically instructed by the NCAA, who probably laughed when they sent them the notification, as I understand it, that was completely and totally illegal. You can't cut someone's financial aid. Like, if you were going to have to institute fines or something, it would have to be done without cutting their checks. So, anyway.
I just wanted to throw it back to John T. to respond to my inquiry there about the you know, can of worms that we've opened.
I think that's a good point. I mean, I like a gold Trans Am as much as anyone, but I think that it is a slippery slope that could get out of hand, and if there's nothing to stop SMU from doing that, then if I were a rich booster, I would say, oh, like, I think I want to be in the Final Four this year, so let's make the cost of attendance as large as we can. Another interesting thing, so they had the vote at the NCAA convention about this. It passed by a vote of 79-1. The only school that voted no, Boston College. The school with the lowest stipend this year of about $1,400, Boston College. Like, wow. Don't like it, and then they're not going to pay the guys. Like, who's going to go to BC?
Now, I have a question, because John's explanation is pretty darn good of how it works. Is it, because it's done by the financial aid office, is it tied to the determination for federal Pell Grants and that sort of thing? In other words, it's obviously because it's a preset number by the financial aid office. At most schools, it's dealing with issues much larger than athletics. It's, you know, it's general scholarship fund. Does it have a federal Pell Grant component? And if so, if all of a sudden you start monkeying around with that, then your cost, because then your Pell Grant money increases if you're tying it directly, because you can't probably show favoritism, then all of a sudden are you dealing with fraud to the federal government at that point? I mean, I'm throwing out questions I don't know the answer to, but maybe that's a restraint on the SMU question proposal that was tossed around.
If you can fill out a form and send it to Gary Parrish, we'll get right on that.
Well, I can't help but think, and I don't want to harp on this, I have said for a decade, longer probably, that I felt student-athletes should be compensated. When I was in graduate school, I worked in student activities. I had free tuition. I had a free place to live. I made about $5,000 a year, and I brought absolutely no revenue and did nothing of any real importance at all. And I realize they say student athletes. They're students first. Well, what about student? What about doctoral students? Are they not students? What about student workers? Are they not students? I mean, why would you pay your RAs but not pay your athletes? I think they deserve something. Having said that, this is ridiculous. The cost of attendance method was ridiculous. What should have been done back in 2011, I don't think we would have near the problems that we have now had they approved the $2,000 stipend across the board for everybody. I think it should have been more than $2,000, but whatever it was, had that passed in 2011, I don't think we'd have a lot of the problems we have now, and that we're probably going to have for all the reasons that you all have said. Like, you know, Alabama, not picking on them, but several schools has suddenly started to have a higher cost of attendance simply so they can pay out a bigger stipend. Not a fan of doing it this way.
And I think that's a very simple solution here. If we put a – it doesn't even need to be a everybody gets $2,000 or everybody gets $5,000 or whatever, but a maximum number. No yeah. conference may award more than X dollars, or no school may award more than X dollars. And if you want to give less, that's fine. That's up to you, but this is a cap. But there is no cap. It's a you schools go figure it out and grant it. And that's why we're seeing, you know, $4,000 disparity 3 miles apart from each other.
Yes.
And if you go back to the list here, which is off of ESPN's website, keep in mind this is just a sampling of colleges at Division I. It's not all 351 that are represented here.
Apparently, if you attend West Point, you need nothing. You can show up with the clothes on your back, and that is all you need. And that's probably true.
It probably is true. So you don't need money for that midnight cheesesteak at West Point, I don't think.
Yes.
You'll be doing push-ups for that.
All right.
Well, with that,
and remember, tuition at West Point's free. Period. You get in. It's
same for the Naval Academy and Air Force.
Yeah, the federal government is picking up your tab. So.
Yeah.
Well, with that, why don't we run through everybody here? If you have any final thoughts for the evening, let's start with David.
I do not. I mean, other than that, the next time we come to you, it will no longer be the off season. It will be the preseason. The preseason starts when we say so.
And how about you, Joby?
Looking forward to going over conference tournaments. We've been kind of itching to talk about the teams themselves. We've done a good job of holding off and tantalizing, but the audience out there will get to hear some of the thoughts about this upcoming season in the next podcast.
All right, and John S.?
Well, a little bit of a sad note. If you've heard the news in the past week, former Iowa great Roy Marble had passed away due to cancer. He was a great player for Iowa in the late 80s, and his son, Roy Devin Marble, had also finished an illustrious career in Iowa and is currently playing in the NBA right now. So our best wishes to the Marble family.
Thank you. Yeah, great point. And our best wishes out to them. John T.
Second that motion. I got to interview Roy a few years ago for a previous website. Very nice guy. As far as my closing note, Harvard's reign of terror in the Ivy League is over, probably. Now that point guard Siani Chambers tore his ACL and is out for the year, I feel terrible, of course. I don't wish ill upon anyone, but as a Penn fan, I'm thrilled that somebody besides Harvard might end up winning the Ivy League this year.
Yeah, you'll be saying the same about Yale after they do it win it this year. But, just as my final note here is that coming up at our next – what's probably our next podcast, probably going to be sometime late October – we are going to make a final decision as to who our adopted team for the season is going to be. As you recall, last year we adopted NJIT and had an amazing run, including the wins at Michigan and the run in the CIT to the semifinals. David, we're going to have to start thinking about who our adopted team is going to be for this year.
We did make a decision.
NJIT again.
Yeah, well, yes, we did make a decision today. It won't necessarily be NJIT, but it can be. Yeah. It doesn't have to be a new team. We've decided that.
Now, personally, I'm thinking about Duke, but we'll get to that next time. And on that note, we're going to thank everybody for joining us, and we'll talk to you again real soon.